Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind. Graphic Audio presents James Axler's Deathlands, narrated by Richard Rowan, with performances by Terrence Aselford, Colleen Delaney, Dolores King-Williams, Amanda Thickpenny, Mort Shelby, Eric Messner, Nanette Savard, Karen Carbone, Ken Jackson, and Joe Brack. Deathlands number 87, Desolation Crossing.
A hard rain's going to fall.
Jack looked up at the clear sky above them.
No rain. Not for quite a while.
The sky was azure, the sun burning red-yellow as it passed its peak, and they entered the afternoon. The heat seemed to bounce off the ground around them and radiate back up, meeting itself so that it created a haze of shimmering air that held them tight. The land surrounding the wag on all sides was barren for as far as they could see.
Rain, sun, who gives a shit? As long as this damn engine doesn't stall.
JB and Christy exchanged glances. Ryan had been in a foul mood since they had acquired the wag. Stranded in a pest hole that went by the name of Strip Mall, they had been short of Jack, short of supplies, and short of work. Like others they had encountered in these wastes, the ragged-assed ville had been devoted to one primary industry, a gaudy house of large proportions, designed to service the trading convoys that had to make the arduous trek across the Dust Bowl lands. All tastes were catered to, and with the friends devoid of any kind of currency, there had been a tacit pressure exerted on the men to push Mildred and Christy into work. After all, muti women with prehensile hair were always at a premium, and there were few black women in this area of the Deathlands. Both of them represented a novelty, which made them potentially high earners. And when Ryan, and JB in particular, had paid no heed to the imprecations, when Millie and Christy had made their own opinions known forcefully, it had become obvious that the choice to say no would soon be removed. So they had made it their business to get the hell out of the ville as soon as possible. A catalog of bad luck had landed them in Strip Mall, and it hadn't got much better when they had been forced to trade what little they had left for a broken-down wag. But it would serve its purpose, they hoped. The wag was a big yellow school bus, the padding long since disintegrated or ripped away from the uncomfortable metal seats. Ryan sat in the driver's seat, stoically trying to pilot the wag that had long since seen its best days. Spread down the length of the bus, the other friends found themselves bounced around like ball bearings, rattling with the same force against the sides of the bus. To make it worse, Ryan was starting to get the feeling that they had been gypped over the amount of fuel in the wag. It was impossible to get an accurate reading as the fuel gauge was broken. And even though they had watched the toothless, scrawny guy they had bartered with fill the tank from battered gas cans, there was no way of knowing what the consumption of the beast may be. Ryan was beginning to fear it was a damn sight less than they had figured. Strip Mall vanished into the haze of the horizon, and now they were surrounded by nothing but dust, blue, and cacti that looked uncannily as if they were moving across the ground. It was as though the companions were isolated from the rest of the world, with nothing but the whine and strain of the engine and the bone-jarring impact of the road to occupy their minds.
We are just desolation angels on the road.
Say what?
Did I say something?
Something but nothing. Same as usual.
Where did you get that from, Doc?
It may have been during my subterranean life, or perhaps when I was on Satori in Paris.
I have seen the best minds of my generation ripped apart. No, torn apart. Is that it?
Something like. I fear your memory may be as faulty as mine, my dear Doctor. which is something that does not perhaps bode well for the future, immediate or long term.
It has been a long time, Doc, both for us and for the rest of what's left of the world. I know I remember that from high school. We had a progressive teacher who wanted us to read more than just the syllabus in lit classes, not just Frost, but the Beats as well. And that was how I came across them. But you...
It was when I was taken from my home and deposited in that purgatory that existed before the purging fire of Skydark. Though it has birthed this wasteland, I suspect that it could not have been that much better in many ways. The stench of corruption always filled my senses back when... where was I? Ah, yes. The road dreams of Kerouac and Cassidy. The endless journeying with no destination in sight and no real goal other than to move on. Perhaps there was an object once. Perhaps, at one time, there was a point to the interminable road. But somewhere along the line, that became lost. And to keep moving was the only goal. What is it, I wonder, that has brought that back to me? Come to that, was the whole thing allegory or metaphor, or was it just the ultimate realization of the dream to be free?
I dream you talk sense one day.
Doc, I asked you how you knew about the Beats and Dylan.
Lilda turned to Christy and JB.
The Beats were a late 20th century group of writers, and Dylan was a singer and poet who wasn't part of them, but was kind of like them. All long after Doc was a young man.
I disagree. I was still a young man. I am still a young man. That which you see is not the real me, but what their meddling has made of me. And yet, they were not all bad. There were some who were interested only in the experiments and found themselves at the behest of those who had power and money. One of them, a doctor called Seeger, was not a bad man, just a misguided one who was out of his moral depth. He consoled himself by reading the books he had treasured as an idealistic student, by listening to the recordings that had fired him on. I recall asking him why he had chosen his path. He grew by turns angry and morose, but in the latter state he was able to give me at least some kind of answer.
What did he tell you?
He said that fate has a way of snatching our dreams and hopes, distorting them in its breeze, tangling them the way that the string of a kite gets tangled by the winds. He said that roads that we travel are not as signposted as we think, and that even if we think that the past has escaped us, for better or for worse, it still has a way of sneaking up, tapping us on the shoulder, and reminding us that those things we thought long since buried have a bearing on where we are now, whether we should like this or not.
So, was he right?
He is long since dust, and I am here. How can I ask him?
Come to that. Would he have a better answer than any of us?
My dear Dr. Wyeth, a doctor of philosophy you should have been.
Doc turned and faced the rear, trying to follow Jack's gaze. In the unfathomable manner he had of snapping from reverie to an alert present, he could tell that the albino youth had caught wind of something on their tail.
What is it, lad? I cannot see.
Not see, hear, feel. Different buzz under the wag noise. Feeling like the road change. Not much, but enough. Bastard heat.
Doc knew what he meant. The heat mist that obscured the true horizon and brought a curtain down between them and Strip Mall limited their field of vision. If something was approaching, then it was not yet near enough to pierce that curtain. Yet, how much time would that cost them? The progress of the old school bus became that bit more torturous, the road that bit more treacherous. At least that was how it seemed, as translated through the steering grip of Ryan Cotter. Maybe it was tension. Maybe the road really had worsened. It didn't matter. All that counted was that it was that little bit harder to cling on and keep rattling eyeballs in focus.
Nearer.
The companions waited. As though in slow motion, and as though materializing from nothing, the pace of the pursuing vehicles caused them to shimmer and take shape as they broke the distance barrier and penetrated beyond the heat haze. There were three of them. Two low-slung wags, like old cars that had been cut down and opened out, to allow the shooters easy access and aim. Not that they would need it, judging from the size of the side-mounted machine guns, each of which looked as though their weight could drag the vehicle to one side without the counterbalance of their opposite mounting. The third vehicle was a motorbike bearing two men, the man on pillion carrying what looked to be a rocket launcher.
Ryan, would it perhaps be possible to squeeze a little more pace from this vehicle? I fear they are starting to gain with some rapidity and will soon be able to test their range.
It doesn't matter how quick they are, what kind of firepower they've got. There's no way I can squeeze any more speed from this bastard. We're gonna have to fight.
Shit! Rocket!
The rocket hit the road, about 100 yards ahead of them. Jack beat out the glass of the back window with the butt of his Colt Python pistol and had the barrel centered on the Pillion Rider. The Pillion Rider flew backward as the round hit him. The velocity of the impact multiplied by the forward motion of the bike. A red mist of blood spread around him. The bike sheared as the rider attempted to cope with a sudden shift in weight and balance presented to him. He failed miserably. The Pillion Rider, now minus half of his viscera and quite dead, had flopped back into the road, causing one of the wags to swerve to avoid hitting him. This attempt to keep hot on the trail would have proved successful, if not for the fact that the rocket launcher that the Pillion Rider had been carrying had parted company from his lifeless grip and skittered across the road and into the path the wag had taken to evade impact. The resultant explosion rocked the air, causing the remaining wag to skid and veer across the surface of the road wildly before righting itself and continuing the pursuit. And now that wag was almost on them. Without pause, Ryan hauled the heavy steering column around so that the old school bus was headed straight for the center of the cacti. As they neared it, he could see that the plants were much larger, much taller than they had appeared from a distance. The actual span of the patch had to have been about 150 yards, and the plants themselves had thick bases at least 6 feet around. Despite the distances and sizes involved, there was no way that he could get the bus through the maze they made without crashing into them. Which was good, because that was his plan.
Away from the window!
Ryan slewed the bus into the middle of the cactus patch. The front fender crunched, the headlight splintered, but the bus barged through, knocking some cacti over at a drunken angle, toppling others completely. The gun-mounted wag hit the cacti patch close now on the tail of the school bus. The way in which the side panels and roof of the wag had been cut away to accommodate the mounting and firing of the machine guns was ingenious and skillfully executed. In normal circumstances, it was to be admired. But these were not normal circumstances, and all it did in this situation was to leave the three inhabitants of the wag wide open to the furies of the cacti. The big, heavy splinters of trunk wood took out the windshield of the wag, making the driver swerve erratically as he tried to avoid the stationary trunks, the flying wood, and still see where he was headed. In a matter of seconds, the outriding gunners were torn to shreds by the thick thorns of the cacti. The driver was still attempting to pilot his vehicle through the carnage caused by the school bus. Suddenly, he lost control and drove the wagon to the base of one of the cacti. Already weakened by a collision with the school bus, it wavered, then slowly tumbled forward down onto the wag, igniting the fuel tank and engulfing cactus and wag in sheets of flame. The enemy had been vanquished. Ryan's main concern now was getting the wag out of the cactus patch without any further damage. Shit! He felt as if he was driving in dizzying circles, growing more and more confused, until he caught a glimpse of clear land beyond. He straightened the wheel and gunned the engine as much as he dared, foot down and headed for empty space. Then the wag crashed out and onto the flat, dry earth.
Shit.
I wonder what it was that they actually wanted. If it was to take our women, then it was a very strange way to do it, to blast us all to annihilation.
Maybe it wasn't that at all. Maybe just sport. Maybe the feed we got this from thought it was still his. It doesn't matter. All that matters is that we get some distance between us and that pest hole.
Ryan got up and went with JB to the side of the wag.
Any damage?
Not anything more than surface. That bastard cactus juice is strong, though.
JB indicated the acid-eaten patches.
Now we got lucky it never got inside. Let's hope we don't have to ride that luck.
They made slow, steady progress for more than 10 miles, putting plenty of distance between themselves and Strip Mall. The old highway seemed to stretch out before them like an endless ribbon, disappearing into the heat haze that was still heavy, even though the afternoon was wearing on. Some of it should have burned off by now, but out here the sun was so intense that any burn was minimal. Which was why the sudden intersection of another blacktop took them by surprise. It seemed to snake from nowhere and cut across the one they drove beside. Ryan pulled the bus up to a halt at the junction and turned to JB.
What do you reckon?
Well, that way's west. We were coming from the southeast to begin with. The way I figure, there's more habitation to the west.
West it is, then.
As the wag roamed around, the steering became unsteady. Suddenly, the bus veered sharply and then tilted forward and slammed to a harsh stop.
Fire blast. What the fuck?
I would wager to suggest that perhaps we were not as lucky as we had assumed.
Yeah, Doc's right there. Always knew our luck couldn't go on.
JB quickly got out of the bus to examine the damage. His head appeared in the doorway a few minutes later.
Nothing good to say. Guess some of that sap shit must have got underneath, and turning the wag sharply hit the weak spot. It's sheared right underneath.
No chance of being able to fix it?
Not unless you got a torch and maybe a replacement axle hidden somewhere in here.
It took the companions a few minutes to gather themselves and assemble outside in the baking heat, where they could survey the damage for themselves.
Shit, we gave our food and water for that.
We just gotta hit the road and hope we reach a fill before we run out. No sense in heading back. May as well keep going west.
You say that like we've got a choice.
They gathered their packs and were ready to begin, when Ryan noticed that Jack had become distracted. The albino teen shook his head.
Trouble. Wags coming from the west, headed straight here. Heavy shit. Should eyeball it soon.
Ryan didn't doubt Jack. Even as he spoke, the sound of a convoy became audible from the distance. In normal circumstances, visual contact would have occurred first, but with this heat haze still rendering a false horizon, normal was a changed thing.
At least they're not from Strip Mall. They might be friendly, or at least inclined to ask first, fire second.
The old boss still had some use. It was a big vehicle, and could at least offer a degree of cover that was sorely lacking in the surrounding environment. The friends adopted positions around the bus that covered them from the oncoming convoy. As it broke through the haze, they could see that it was at least 5 wags strong, with a heavily armored vehicle at the front. They would have expected it to either fire on them from a distance, a make-sure defensive measure, or to approach them close up, knowing that the armored wag offered protection. Instead, the wag pulled up about 1,000 yards away, the rest of the convoy coming to a halt at its rear. It sat there, immobile, for some time.
What's his game?
An interesting one. Is he trying to draw our fire?
Bastard, strange way to do it.
Then the offside door of the wag opened, and a squat, muscular man emerged. Dressed in a black vest and camo pants, with heavy boots and a khaki bandana, he was holding a white cloth above his head. Slowly, he began to walk toward them. As he got closer, they could see that he was wearing the bandana out of vanity for his bald head, although the rest of him was hairy, down to the bushy black beard flecked with gray that flowed onto his chest. His eyes were hidden behind mirrored aviator shades.
He triple stupid something?
Or triple smart. We're not going to fire on him when he's unarmed but has all that firepower at his back. That'd be like saying, please chill me.
Might be muty, Stoops. Still taking a big chance.
Looks like the kind of guy that's based his life around taking chances. You don't get a traitor with a wag like that unless you're prepared to walk the line.
They've got us covered. Must have.
Probably long range. Maybe they even got one of those working infrareds or heat seekers so they can see how many of us there are. We make one move and we've bought the farm before he even needs to duck and cover.
The group laid their weapons at ease. By this time, the heavyset man was in hailing distance.
Said looks like you got trouble there. Thinking maybe you could use some help.
That's good of you to offer help, especially to strangers. But it's not the way things usually are. People in these parts usually come in blasting first, asking questions second. That's if there's anyone left to ask.
True, but there are some people I'm looking for in these parts. I figure you may be them.
How come?
I heard tell that a certain group of fighters were in these parts. I know their reputation. I know that they were last heard of in Strip Mall, and that no one who isn't a Gotti or paying Mark is welcome there for long. And I know that there are 6 of you using that wag as cover.
You're certain of a lot of things. Means you must have good information and some serious tech.
You're damn right I have. I didn't get to be the best trader in these parts of land without having a nose for useful shit. I like useful. I like good. And you people have a rep as being the best.
How do you hear so much?
Tell you something. I got this armorer, and she's obsessed by stories about you people. She's also got a nose for ordnance, like you wouldn't believe. She's got 2 big goals in her life, much as she'll let me know. One is to have the best armory of any trader. The other is to work with you guys. I trust her word on how good you are. But listen, don't just take my word for it.
Slowly, so as to show that he had no concealed weapon, he lifted his right hand until it touched the side of his face.
Eula! Get your ass out here, but slow!
The man carefully put his hand down.
Something she scoped out for me. Some old tech equipment that enables us to communicate without having to carry a lot of shit. See, she's good. But don't take my word for it, she's coming.
From beyond the heavyset trader, they could see someone exit the armored wag and start to walk slowly toward them with a purposeful stride and a gait that suggested that she was not to be trifled with. She was barely more than 5 feet tall and slight in build. She was dressed in black, vest, skirt, and leggings, with heavy boots that seemed too large for her. Her hair was also raven black, tied in a ponytail that whipped behind her with every stride. She was carrying a 7.62mm assault rifle that seemed too large for her. When Eula was level with the trader, she stopped. She didn't bother to look at him.
Been looking for you people a long time, if you're who I think you are. I've got a lot to learn from you. We all have. Especially J.B. Dix. Met him once. Remember him well.
Behind the bus, Mildred looked at the armorer.
You know who she is, John?
She doesn't look all that old. If it had been recent times, then all of you would have known her, too. But if I do know her, then it must have been when she was real small. I don't recognize the name, either.
Well, she knows you. What's more, that fact looks like it may save our asses for now. So you better remember, in case she gets pissed at the fact that you can't.
Well, you gonna come out? Or you still figure that we want to chill you?
Could have done that a long time back. We're coming out.
The friends emerged from the cover of the old school bus. As they did, they could see that Eula was scoping them. She turned to the trader and nodded. She was satisfied they were who they were supposed to be, which was some kind of comfort, Ryan figured. At least they were safe, for now. Eula spent the longest time staring at JB. Her expression was cryptic, and it made the armorer feel uncomfortable.
You don't remember me, do you, John Barrymore Dix?
I don't.
Don't worry. It was a long time ago. And no one noticed me back then. No one.
Guthrie was a nowhereville, a small pestle of huts and small hovels constructed from the debris that could be scavenged. The people made some desultory attempts at farming, but the nature of the Dust Bowl soil meant that the few crops it could produce were stunted and lacking in nutrients. It was off the beaten tracks and ruined blacktops that still crisscrossed the Midwest, and those who lived there had a legend that they only landed up there because they got lost on the way to somewhere else. The ville itself was named after the guy who was the first to erect a little hut that fell down many times before others stumbled on him and built a few little huts of their own. J.B. Dix had ended up in the pestholeville of Guthrie in much the same way as anyone else who arrived there, by accident and less than willingly. The skinny youth was quiet, slight, wiry, and wore spectacles that he was almost always polishing. He never said a word if he could help it, although if a person got him talking about blasters, that was another matter. You couldn't shut him up, and he'd talk about stuff that no one else in Guthrie gave a shit about. So, after a while, they stopped asking, and he stopped talking. What they really wanted to know was where he'd come from, why he'd landed in Guthrie, and what the hell had happened to cause him to run. But any attempt to broach that subject was met with a greater silence than was usual. And it wasn't just a matter of his being a quiet kid. There was something else there, a kind of menace that said it would be a real bad idea to mess with him. So no one did. Except for Jeb Willits, who was big and muscular and therefore so out of place in Guthrie that he was able to bully his way around the ville. He figured the little kid with the bad eyes would be an easy mark, and at first he'd seemed right. He'd taken him by surprise and landed a few blows that seemed to knock the hell out of the kid, but Dix was sly. A feint, a foot, a use of balance that the lumbering Willits wasn't used to, and the big man was on the ground, unconscious. Then the thing that really made them leave JB alone. While Willits was unconscious, the skinny kid wired his shack to blow with some explosive he'd made. Then, when Willits was recovered, Dix took him at knife point and made him watch as the shack blew. No one stepped in. The truth was, they all wished that they could have done that to the man. Willits was broken and left the ville soon after. And no one asked JB any questions. They left him alone. He liked it that way. Of course, a man had to live, and one of the few things that he ever let out about himself was that he came from Colorado way, from a ville called Cripple Creek. He said nothing about family, but only mentioned it by way of saying that since he was young, he'd been fascinated by weapons and explosives, and had educated himself in seeing what made them work, taking them apart and putting them back together again in better working condition than he'd found them. He knew the pre-dark histories of the things, and he'd tell you about them while he was taking your beat-up old blaster and making it shiny like new. The kid had a talent. It was the one time he didn't shut up, and no one wanted to know. But nonetheless, you had to give it to him. So most of the time, you just leave the blaster with him and let him bring it back to you when it was done. That was fine. You paid him jack if you had any, or else you gave him food or supplies of some kind. There were convoys that passed in or near from time to time, and there was usually some service or some goods that Guthrie could use for exchange. It wasn't living, but it was existing. You didn't buy the farm, and that was enough for most people. It was enough for the young J.B. Dix, for the time being. That changed when Trader chanced upon the shanty.
Why do we always end up in shit heaps like this?
Hunniker scratched at herself. She could already feel the bug starting to bite. She looked out of Warwag 1 at the expanse of dust, ordure, and ramshackle buildings that made up the ville.
We're supposed to be the best, so why do we bother?
Hun, sometimes I can't believe how stupid you can be. For someone so smart, you don't do a lot of thinking. How do you reckon we got to where we are? I'll tell you. It's because we pay attention to detail. You never know what's out there until you look. That's how come I found the stash that set us up. And that's how come we keep getting bigger while all those other traders just bitch and whine and wonder how we did it.
And you reckon we'll find something here?
Poet leaned over them both.
Ever known trader to be wrong?
There's always a first time.
By the time they'd finished wrecking the ville, their smiles had gone, and they were figuring that maybe Hunt had been right. There was nothing in this pest hole to interest them. They'd made some sparse business just for the sake of it, and because Trader had a few commodities he was overstocked with that he could afford to let go at a low rate. Never knew when they might come back this way, and they wanted a hospitable rather than hostile reception. Come to that, it would ensure that they left on friendly terms, rather than in the wake of a firefight. Because these were mean folk, more so than in many other places. The misery of their existence saw to that. So it looked as though this little detour would draw a blank, and it would be little more than just some wasted fuel. Until the one thing that had been nagging at Trader the whole while suddenly clicked in his mind.
Poet, you notice something about these folks?
Other than they're being meaner than a muty rattlesnake with a jolt hangover?
Yeah, other than that. Take a look at their blasters.
Nice gear. Wouldn't like to have to face them down with those, even with all the ordnance we carry.
Too true, Poet, but think about it. This place is knee-deep in its own shit, with nothing to offer us in any way, to offer anyone who passes through. So how come they have such good ordnance?
Let me ask a few questions.
Which didn't prove too hard. There was only one bar in the ville, and although the brew it purveyed was of a poor quality, indeed, Poet felt he drunk better sump oil than this filth, it was all the locals had, and they were more than happy to let a lonely traveler spend some jack on getting drunk with them. He had plenty to spare, it seemed, and was more than happy to spend. Get him drunk enough, and there was the chance of rolling him, boosting the local economy, and getting one over on an outlander, which was always a local favorite. Except that Poet had drunk more and far better men under the table than lived in Guthrie, and for all its foul taste, the local brew was nowhere near as strong as some that he'd tasted over the years. So it wasn't long, and not so deep in his pocket as he'd feared, that Poet had turned the tables and had the locals on the subject of their hardware. A little flattery about how good their blasters were compared to some he'd seen on his travels, and they were soon telling him about their little secret advantage in the matter. And it didn't take them much to start speculating on J.B. Dix. The taciturn and private teenager who'd arrived the previous fall had been a hot topic of conversation ever since. Tongues loosened, Poet had to put up with a whole lot of speculation that was of no use to him, but he did work out, among the drivel and drunken babble, that the young man had a rare talent. But he figured Trader would feel wasted in this backwater. So it was that the following afternoon, while a Poet busied himself, and those he had drunk with still nursed the mother, father, son, and daughter of all hangovers, Trader made his way to the small shack that the mysterious J.B. Dix had made his home.
Speak to your son?
Trader hovered in the doorway. The young man said nothing, hunched over an old Smith & Wesson 38 snubby, meticulously cleaning and reassembling the weapon. The pieces he had finished with were immaculate. The pieces he had yet to reach looked as if they came from a different blaster.
What do you want?
I heard you've got a talent for this sort of thing. I've got some ordnance that needs work. You care to take a look?
It'll cost you.
We'll see. See what kind of a job you do.
It'll be good.
I'll be back.
Trader left without another word from the taciturn teenager. He walks back to Warwag 1 and found that Poet had finished his allotted task, and he sent him along to the kid with a screwed-up ordnance. Poet returned a few minutes later, shaking his head.
Kid said to come back tomorrow, didn't even bother looking up.
The next morning, when Trader arrived at the ramshackle hut in which JB had made his home, he found that the kid was ready and waiting for him.
Sit down.
Trader eyed the chair warily. It looked like it might collapse under his weight.
So, why are you jerking me around?
What makes you say that?
There was nothing wrong with your blasters. At least there was nothing wrong till you or one of your people tried to mess them up.
What makes you say that?
Normal wear and tear. Stoop assholes misusing ordnance. That's easy to spot. Just like it was easy to spot that someone had tried to make these blasters look misused and to fuck up the most difficult shit to fix. That just doesn't happen in regular use. Maybe 1 in 10 if you're unlucky, but not every single one.
You got me. I wanted to see how good you were.
Why?
Because I want you to join us. I don't know why you're stuck in this pest hole, and the truth is I don't care. But I do know this. You're wasted here. We could do with someone like you.
Whoever messed those blasters for you knew what they were doing.
True enough. But while they might have been able to put them right, they wouldn't have known that they'd been deliberately messed with to begin with. That, Mr. Dix, is a true talent. And I could do with true talent. I've got the best convoy in these lands, and I got it by keeping my eye open for opportunity. The way I figure it, we pick up armament to trade cheap that are fucked up, you fix them, and we make a good profit. More than we do now. And with you, one of us, we get to have the best armory of any convoy should anyone try to mess with us.
And I get?
Good, Jack. I look after my people in other ways, too. You play straight with me, you won't find a better boss nor baron anywhere. I figure that if I treat my people good, they won't rip me off or run. Mind, you step out of line, and I'll cheer you myself.
JB said nothing for some time, just stared at the man in front of him. Trader felt like the young man was trying to stare deep into his soul to work him out. It wasn't pleasant, but it was promising. Someone this careful wasn't liable to screw up easily.
As long as there's no more stoop tricks or tests like this one, then I'm in. It's about time I got out of this no-horse shit heap.
Reckon you're about right. Welcome aboard Warwag 1.
In the moment since Eula had spoken, a silence had spread uncomfortably over the oddly clustered group. On one side stood Eula and the traitor. On the other stood the 6 friends. JB was staring at the young woman. The others were dividing their attention between the armorer and Eula, trying to fathom what ghost had just snaked from JB's past and how it would affect them.
Listen, you say you know me, but I gotta tell you, I don't recognize your face, and you're not that old. I mean, I spent a lot of time with these people over the past few years, and you would have been a child.
JB could feel the others watch the traitor and the woman, could feel the tension as they waited to read body language, the tightening of their posture as they prepared to act. The traitor looked at the woman beside him. She looked in turn, with a level gaze, at JB.
Well?
He's right. I remember him, but it was a long time ago now. I was just a kid, and he wouldn't have noticed me back then. Always interested in ordnance. People came second. Bet they still do. Got a point, though. Blasters don't let you down like people do.
JB's answer was important. No one knew that better than him. His words were measured, much more than he was used to. He knew that he had to pick each one as carefully as he, usually so dismissive of words, could.
And one thing you learn as you get older is that ordnance is important because it helps people. Get careful with that, and it can turn a firefight, defend a vill, a convoy. And someone sure as shit has to obsess at times to make sure that can happen.
Yeah, that's a good lesson to learn. Hope you didn't pick it up the hard way.
Depends on what you think is the hard way.
Eula gave the briefest of nods. Everything, it seemed, was minimal to the point of almost non-existence with her, before answering the questioning gaze of the traitor. The traitor let a wry grin spread across his dark, bearded face.
It's okay, guys. Listen, I gotta be straight with you here. If we wanted to take you out, we could have done it without even breaking a sweat. We got the firepower to do it, and it would have been easy to reduce that shitty little wag you were stuck with to a heap of melted junk metal. No problem. But our tech and the intel we picked up along the road suggested that you were the people Eula here has heard of, and we need someone like you right now. So that's why we stopped, and I offered myself up like this. Sure, you could try and chill me. I figure my wag would have taken you out before your fingers had even tightened on those triggers. Maybe that's a gamble, but you don't get anywhere by playing it safe the whole time.
So what's your proposition?
Simple, really. I need replacements in my sec force. We had a little run-in with another convoy down the road a piece. Left me light on manpower.
That's a mite careless for a man who's telling us about how good his tech is.
Sure enough. Trouble is, the tech isn't always what you need. We don't have the night vision shit working on the WAG, and one of my rivals decided to pay us a little visit in the dark. His men crept in on us, and I guess I found that my boys weren't as sharp as they thought they were. Maybe the tech has been too good to them, to us, made us a little soft. I guess I should level with you. Eula knows of you because of J.B. Dix, but the stories about you spread across the lands. We should know we spend most of our time on the road. You used to be with Trader, right? Guy who was the biggest thing in convoys before he disappeared. Now there are a lot of stories about him too, and everyone has their own reason for why he went missing. I figure that maybe he just made so much jack that he could afford to not lay his ass on the line every day, and that maybe he's back where he got his shit in the first place, just enjoying every day.
The group's silence just encouraged the traitor to run off at the mouth all the more. Sooner or later, he'd tell them exactly what he wanted. But while he was letting this much slip, it wasn't worth telling him to cut to the chase.
Yeah, well, if he is, then good luck to him. He earned it the hard way, and I tell you something. When I get the chance, I'm sure as shit gonna go the same way. Meantime, I gotta earn that jack. And I'm down on the number of men I need to cover my back, so I've got a proposition for you. We got a run to do that some folks think is nothing short of asking to buy the farm. It's gonna take balls, but the way I hear it, that's something you people ain't short of. Even the women. That's cool if you ladies are anything like Eula, then I'm okay with that. I need replacement sec, and for a hard ride. I don't expect you to sign up for the long haul. Hell, I don't even want that myself. But I tell you what I can offer. If we make the trip and you join us, there'll be good jacking it for you. More than that, it'll get you the hell out of here. Because I'm thinking that right now you ain't got no wag, and no way you can get out of this wasteland in one piece. I figure that does all my arguing for me.
Ryan considered that. They'd be trusting a man who was too full of himself for the one-eyed man's liking, and taking on the wild card that was whatever agenda Eula was bringing to the table. On the other hand, there was little to gain by staying where they were.
Well, I guess you have a point, stranger. We're in a situation here that you'd call no win. Staying here is as good as buying the farm. Just stringing out the agony, I guess. But we're taking a leap into the dark if, and it is if, we take up your offer. If we knew exactly what we were taking on...
As Ryan had hoped, the trader grimaced as he tried to hold his feelings in check and not let anything slip. But he was too garrulous, too open for that.
All right, all right. I kind of wanted to get you signed up and with the plan before I told you too much, but if that's what it takes... Okay, it's this way. I got a cargo of food supplies, some self-heats, dried stuff, fresh produce that we can keep that way with some old refrigeration units we plundered, and a whole lot of clothing. We're headed across this pest-hole stretch of land, headed for the far side. It's a bastard of a haul, and there's shit all in the way of stops along the way. At least, none that I would trust.
If they're anything like strip mall, then I can understand that.
My friend, they make strip mall look like a paradise. Point is, we don't have the fuel to keep the wags and the generators for the fresh stuff running if we make stops. We can only do it if we run hell for leather across this asswipe land. Hell, even stopping here is losing valuable time. We can make maybe one, two brief stops a day if we have to.
So what's your problem? Back in the day when me and JB ran with Trader, we used to make long runs as a matter of course.
You ever do the Dust Bowl?
We came this way a few times. No trader used to do it before I joined up.
Yeah, but never in one long run.
There's a reason for that. It's the Badlands, man. Rough Riders and Wag Riders. There's fuck all out here. So they have to do what they can, which means chilling and stealing anything that passes by and isn't defended by serious hardware. There's only one convoy that tried the straight run, and it didn't make it. So now it's our turn. We need new sec, and we want the best. From what I hear, that's you people. Reckon fate has smiled upon me, if not us all, matching us up like this.
Yeah, I figure you leave us no choice. But even so, we'd be stupid if we said yes without knowing what kind of ordnance you had.
Best you'll find. Better than J.B. Dix will have seen for many a year.
You bet it is. Hell, it'd be impolite to ask you aboard without showing you.
The man spoke into his ear set.
Stand down, we're coming back. Everything's cool.
The trader turned, beckoning them to follow. Eula stood back, still cradling the 7.62mm weapon that looked too large for her. Her impassive face still gave nothing away. She was no threat at present. The manner in which Christie's sentient hair flowed free only reinforced this impression, but she would still need to be watched. As they traveled the short distance between their original position and the armored wag, they were able to see more clearly the extent of the convoy. There were four other wags. Two of them were large trailers, closed in on all sides. These were obviously the old refrigeration units. The cabs attached to them had been reinforced with mesh where any glass was visible, armor plating covering the remainder. The old paintwork along the sides of both cabs and wags was pitted and scarred where it was still visible. Camo had been painted over most of the rest. There were also a number of scores and scorch marks that made the friends wonder once more about how they had been acquired. These wags had only gun ports in the cabs. Although they would be hard to damage in themselves, their length and lack of slits made them vulnerable to blind spot attack. That was probably why they sat in the middle of the convoy, flanked by two wags that carried the rest of the cargo. These were armored, with gun ports and slits. They had been converted, and both Ryan and JB could only admire the work that had gone into them. They looked to be solid vehicles, but they weren't big. If the cabs on the refrigerated wags could hold two people, these only held three or four tops. Maximum of 12 crew. The armored wag out front was more impressive. Again, it wasn't just the size, although it was a heavy-duty pre-dark military wag, dark and heavy in color, albeit a little chipped and faded by combat. It was squat, with tires at front and a caterpillar track at the rear. It had bubble-mounted machine guns, ob slits, shielded surveillance tech, and two large mounted cannon. It could do some serious damage to anything that dared to go up against it.
How much of the tech in that still work?
Most of the surveillance tech, some of the weapon systems. Much of it was fixable, but, it's a little erratic.
Eula, you don't find that a problem?
It hasn't failed yet.
But what about the tech that needed satellite shit? That can't be working.
I said some, not all.
Hasn't seen me wrong yet. This is it, guys, the convoy. Now, there used to be two motorbikes, but they got wasted in our little, contretemps?
Say what?
An old word, dear boy, not English. I believe he's referring to the firefight he mentioned earlier.
She should fucking say so.
How many people you carry?
This takes five people. Full complement of sec, drivers, workers, comes to 17 on a trip.
Yeah, and how many you carrying now?
That's the thing. We lost 8 in a firefight.
You lost half your people, and you don't think that was a little careless?
Two went at the back. The bike riders are always the first to cop it. We did salvage the bikes, though. As for the other six, we had a direct hit on one wag that took out three people, two straight away and one the day after. The wags are good and strong, but it was the concussion of the blast that did it for them. Stupid thing is that they were chilled by their own weapons going off in the wag. Pathetic. Two sec men bought the farm trying to protect the refrigerators. You can see those bastards are blind and they had to get out of the cabs. I think we learned from that, and they did. Just a shame it was too late.
And the last one? So far, you have mentioned only 5 casualties.
Penn, best quartermaster I ever had. Just a little too protective of his post, that was all. He saw a group of cold hearts from the other convoy trying to bust into one of the wags and saw red. He was traveling with us and was out of there before anyone had a chance to stop him. He was shouting at them to stop, firing off without aiming, and, well, they just picked him off. One shot, bang. Took the poor, stoop bastard's head off. Swear his body kept running for 1 yard before he went down.
If Ryan hadn't believed a word the man had said before this, then now he certainly had no faith. The story was crap. Just like the rest of it. No one who served time on a convoy would be so stoop. Just as no one who had served time would get chilled by their own weapons when their wag got hit. Why were they drawn when they were inside, and unnecessary? Whatever had really happened, that hadn't been what the traitor wanted them to believe.
Okay, we'll join you. But if we're going to work together, what do we call you?
Laguerre. Armand Laguerre. But you call me boss. No. Only kidding.
Saying nothing more, Ryan took his hand, then looked at his people with an expression that communicated his own reservations were as deep as theirs. At least they had transport out of here. Say what you like about Laguerre, Mildred mused, but he wasn't as big a fool as you'd take him for. He didn't survive as a traitor by being stupid, And if, as they suspected, the firefight that had deprived him of nearly half his crew had less to do with being attacked than with being the attacker, then he wasn't the complete idiot he seemed. No, it seemed to Mildred that he had a certain cunning, a certain base instinct that could kick in and override the tendency to let his mouth run away with him. A garrulous yet cunning fool. It was a combination that was volatile and could only end one way. The question was, when? In the meantime, he had been smart enough to keep the friends apart. He had something he wanted from them, and he had found a way to get it without allowing them the space and time to confer, to make plans of their own and put them into action. Did he realize that they didn't trust him? Or did he just assume that no one trusted him, and in their turn were to be trusted themselves? Ultimately, she figured that it didn't matter. The result was the same, no matter what you may surmise. The friends had been divided among the wags of the convoy, and the salvaged bikes had been put to use. It made sense from a SEC point of view to use a newly recruited group of proven fighters in such a manner. Hell, she would have done it that way herself. But there was something. Maybe it was just that she didn't trust Laguerre. No, there really was something about the man that suggested he knew this was a good move for him as much as for the convoy. Keep them apart and they couldn't conspire. So it was that Ryan and Jack rode the motorbikes at the back of the convoy, the leader and the most dangerous and quick of the fighters. A coincidence? Mildred didn't think so. It made sense for the two of them to ride at the rear of the convoy as they were the best suited to combat and the demands of instant response from such a position, but still, it seemed too convenient. Christy and herself were now riding shotgun in the refrigerated wags. Doc rode the wag at the rear of the convoy. One of Laguerre's men had been shifted from the armored wag to the one directly behind. The purpose of that had been to allow JB to ride the armored lead wag, which was suspicious in itself. At least it seemed so to Mildred. If they had replaced Sec at the rear of the convoy and in all the other wags, then why not put JB in the wag directly behind the armored leader? That would have been consistent. The action that Laguerre had taken was anything but. Mildred couldn't help wondering if this last course of action was due to Laguerre or at the prompting of Eula. For now, JB was in the wag with her, which would give her plenty of time to... Well, to what? What was her link to John? In what way were they connected? Mildred knew John well enough. When he had said that he had no idea who the young woman was or why she knew so much about him, Mildred had believed him. So who was she? What did she want? And how would that affect JB and the companions? Whatever the outcome, it was impossible to do anything while they were separated. Come to that, it was proving impossible to get anything in the way of sense out of her current companion. Reese, the driver of the refrigerated wag, was a large woman. Probably 250 pounds of her was crammed behind the wheel of the big rig. Not an ounce of it fat. Her knees looked cramped, even in the space of the cab, and she was over 6 feet tall. She was dark and heavyset, with crude tattoos on her upper arms and multiple piercings in her upper lip, brow, and ears. Mildred had tried to ask a few questions, nothing too deep, just general conversation about the convoy and the way in which they usually traveled. Would there be rest stops, and when did they generally occur? This last was the kind of question any newcomer to convoy SEC would ask, leaving aside Mildred's real reason of wanting to know when she would be able to communicate with the others.
Not anyone's business. Happens when it happens.
Mildred noted that the cab was fitted with ComTech and was in touch with all wags on the convoy. Not that you would know it so far, as it seemed that radio contact was kept to a minimum. Doc was getting along just fine. He was in the wag at the rear of the convoy. If he looked out of the ob slit at the back of the wag, he could just about see Ryan and Jack as they weaved in and out of the dust.
I did not know that young Jack was such an accomplished rider, though I would imagine he's a wow on one of those, skateboards, yes.
When he turned back to face the interior of the wag, he took in both the view and the warm thug of people forced to live close together. Too close. There were two other inhabitants, one of whom was currently trying to sleep. Her name was Raven, and when he had expressed surprise at her being a redhead and not yet black, she looked at him as though he were insane. Doc, of course, was used to this and let it slip over him. As of yet, he did not know from whence she had derived that charming name, but no doubt he would elicit this information sooner or later, when her temper improved.
She's not normally like this. It's just that we're not really letting her sleep. Taryn, the guy you replaced, he was real quiet. Never used to talk to me much at all. which was a pain in the ass, as it usually gets real lonely and dull on some of these drives. We used to have an old tech disc player, and I'd play some old tunes from before Skydark. She used to moan about that, too. So I gave it to Ray in the end. You'll like Ray. Not just because he's old, like you, but because he never shuts up. Talks kind of odd, too, like you.
Yeah, like you don't. You don't get me talking nonstop when you're trying to sleep.
No, you had other things on your mind.
The driver's name was Ramona, and she was dark where Raven was pale.
I tell you what, Doc, her moaning used to wake me up. Sometimes she'd let Taryn play with her pussy while she was driving. Damn near could have driven us off the road. Worse, the bitch used to let him drive sometimes, swapping while the wag was still in motion and suck his dick while he was driving. Damn unsafe.
You wouldn't have said that. You saw the size of his dick. No way something that small could have caused any accidents.
Both begin with an R. It's interesting. Does Laguerre do that on purpose, I wonder, in the same way that most of his convoy crew are women?
You know, I take it back, Doc. You're way crazier than Ray. Begin with an R? What kind of question is that? You want to know something about Armand, baby? Then you just ask outright.
Very perceptive, I must say. But nonetheless, it was a genuine question. Is it something to do with the way his mind works that he places in the same wags operatives who have identical initials?
Man, how many ways and how many words can you use in that question?
Whoa. Okay, keep talking. This is sending me to sleep, all right.
It's all to do with psychology, madam. Are you familiar with that term?
Not as familiar as I hope to be with you, you old hunk of man. You sweet-talking me like that. Say what? Listen up. The only reason we're both on this wag is because we've been with Armand the longest, and this is the wag with the jack. He trusts us.
Doc eyed the interior of the wag once more. There was one seat up front for the driver, another at the rear for the sec man, which he occupied. The bunk on which Raven lay was along one wall, with a makeshift kitchen area, no more than a hot plate and a small icebox at the foot. A small comm unit and some tech reception equipment was on the wall opposite. An old safe with a combination lock was beside it. The rest of the space in the narrow wag, apart from an even more narrow channel they all used to negotiate the interior, was taken up with a stock that could not have been fitted into the front wag.
It's a combination safe. You may not know the combination.
Yeah, we do. Someone gotta know it other than Armand, in case he buys the farm before we get to destination. He changes it every time. Don't know how he does that, though. Guess he trusts us, but not that much. Must do some, otherwise we could just take the bastard and blow it with Plasex.
A fair point. Laguerre seems to be a deeper thinker than perhaps, if you'll excuse me, he appears.
Armand ain't exactly what you call sharp in some ways. But in others he is. Kinda. Guess he's like all of us. He's good at some shit and, well, shit at other shit.
His secret seemingly is that he knows the dividing line.
Guess you could say that about anybody, honey. And you know, you're right. Most of the driving crew have always been women, except Ray, but I kind of don't know about him sometimes. Quartermaster and Sec have always been male. Quartermaster? Couldn't say why. Sec? I guess it kind of makes sense. Most guys are stronger like that. I know I couldn't have beaten Taryn in a fight of any kind, and Raven there always got herself pinned down. But maybe that was different. Anyways, Armand does like to use women more than most traders I've seen. Of course, as we're all so grateful for work and Jack, it does mean the boy has pussy on tap.
And that would include the young woman, Eula?
You have got to be shitting me, Doc, baby. Think if he dared to pull it out near that one, she'd damn near whip it off with her knife. Maybe not right off. Just leave him something as a reminder of what a bad boy he'd been.
Something about her that is real scary, though. Tell you, Doc, me and her over there have been together in this convoy for some time now, and we get on okay. Hellfire, everyone in here gets on okay with one another, really. That's what Armand likes. A happy crew does good work, he says. What the sneaky fuck means is that a happy crew ain't gonna slit his throat and run off with his jack. Anyway, Eula comes in, and things ain't quite the same anymore. She don't talk none.
I would suppose that would make you distrust her, as you all seem to be a little on the garrulous side.
Honey, I don't know what that word means, but it ain't nice, I can tell. Ain't true either, if it means what I think. Because you ain't met Reese. She don't say more than 5 words a year, and mostly that's to tell you to fuck off.
Reese?
Big muscle fucker. Traveling with the sister, lucky her. No, Reese is okay. Just a little quiet and scary. but openly. Unlike our gal Eula. She's too damn quiet in the wrong way. And it's like she's always brooding on something. Something to hide. She looks at you like you're shit on her shoes. Like she's got some little list in her head where she's adding up the good and the bad. I know what it's like. It's like when Armand adds up the jack and stock he's got and that he's got rid of and see if it balances. That's what she's doing. She's got something on her back that's weighing her down, and some fucker's gonna get it big when she finds out who it is.
And you think it may be my friend?
We don't know, do we? But she sure as shit seems to know him, even if he don't know her. Think he does and he's not letting on to you, Doc? No offense, like, but are you sure?
I have known John Barrymore for some time now, and in times of emergency, the man has always been straight. No, if he does know anything about her, he is truly unaware of it. It may be a mistake on her part. There was certainly no mistaking the bemusement on his face. Our good armorer cannot hide certain things. He is controlled and can mask emotion in combat, but he can be caught on the quick. And this was such a time. Tell me, ladies, what do you know of this Eula?
About as much as you, hon. She says she comes from the east, and sure, we picked her up there. But you don't say where, or how she learned so much about blasters and shit. Don't say much about nothing. Tell you, don't even think Armand knows much about her. Tell you something else, though. He thinks she's powerful medicine, and he trusts her judgment.
And you do not?
Hon, I trust that bitch even less than I could throw her scrawny ass.
See, thing is, we ain't really got no secrets from each other, any of us. Can't do if you travel like we do, and for as long as we have. Secrets you'd like to have sometimes, sure, but it don't work that way. That's part of being a team, right? Sooner or later it comes out, or you walk. Now, you take Eula. That bitch is so tight it even pains her to piss. But no matter how hard she wants to keep it in, sooner or later, it's gonna come out. And she ain't the type to walk, if even the wildest guess comes close. And that's what we're kind of afraid of. Right, Ramona?
Damn straight.
Doc kept his own counsel for once. He suspected Eula's secret was inextricably tied to the armorer, and two taciturn people in the same wag would be oppressive to the point where the pressure would blow. The only questions were when and how.